We're on a mission to explore how emerging technologies, media, robotics, and data and behavioral science will solve humanity's most pressing challenges. From education, mobility, energy, food and water supplies, the environment, employment, all the way to disease and basic human rights. Nothing is off limits. This episode is brought to you by Beverage Universe. They have every flavor to help you stay young, beautiful, and thirsty. Go to beverageuniverse.com for your next flavor experience. Today I have Dr. Sean Stein-Smith, who is an assistant professor at Lehman College for Business and Economics. Welcome, Sean.
Afternoon. Happy to be here.
Thank you for being here. Sean has actually published 5 books around the topics of AI and financial services. Some of the books are The Effect of Integrated Financial Reporting on Financial Performance, Strategic Management Accounting, Common Sense Finance for Individuals and Entrepreneurs. I think a lot of us could use that. Integrated Reporting Management. And his latest book is on blockchain and artificial intelligence and financial services, what the implications and applications for financial professionals.
Yeah.
Time to do all this?
I don't sleep a lot.
Love
my coffee. And, you know, I mean, honestly, this whole area is so fast moving and so interesting. And I've been working in it for 10 years now. So to me, it's all easy and fun and just natural to write about it, talk about it, do some podcasts about it. So all the rest.
You have to be one of the very few people that says talking about integrated reporting management is fun.
Somebody has to do it, right?
No, I believe me, I'm fully on board. So tell me a bit about your background and how did you get into this?
Sure. So probably the best way to sort of summarize it in a quick manner is basically before moving over into higher ed about 2.5 years ago, I spent about 8 to 9 years in industry, working in corporate accounting, corporate finance, working almost as a half IT, half accounting role. And so as a result of that, I was always pretty hands-on and interested in sort of how technology impacts processes and controls, and then how that ultimately impacts the work of folks working in accounting, in finance, and then sort of now sort of in the banking and sort of the markets area too. And then so this whole tidal wave of toys almost, right? You know, blockchain, AI, Bitcoin, I mean, all of that stuff is just cool stuff to analyze and to then sort of build on, right? My own background from industry to analyze really how all these big changes are impacting every aspect of accounting, finance, markets, trading, all the rest.
When was the first moment when you realized, holy cow, this is going to really impact everything?
I mean, I'd say probably that holy cow moment for me was for, you know, blockchain and cryptocurrency. I'd say that was really back in 2016 or so, right? And for anybody who has not seen it yet, there's a great movie on Netflix, Banking on Bitcoin. It's a great movie, easy to watch, and has interviews with all of the real people who were there back in like 2012, 2013, 2014, back before Bitcoin was a mainstream headline news story. And I sort of came across it almost by accident. I was doing some research, doing some work, doing my doctorate on how so different technology systems can help companies better report their information. And so I heard this blockchain thing and Bitcoin. Now, at the time, I was like, Bitcoin's not a big deal, whatever. I was totally wrong there, by the way. But the underlying technology, right, that blockchain, that ability to store and to share data on a continuous basis and to do so in a manner that on the Bitcoin blockchain has been unhackable up until now, I mean, that blew my mind because that changes everything, right? From a accounting point of view, from an audit point of view, from a banking point of view, from a traceability point of view. I mean, there's all types of applications for it out there.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about the work that you're doing at Lehman College.
Sure. So I'd say at Lehman, I teach courses focusing on advanced accounting, advanced accounting topics, and then honestly trying to bridge that gap between MIS, computer science, and accounting, right? Because really, I mean, ask anybody in accounting or in finance, and honestly, IT and the capability to work with IT is more and more sort of our jobs, right? And so that's what I'm trying to do. On top of teaching the debits, the credits, cash flows, all the rest, I'm always trying to weave in those sort of hot topics, right? Be it AI, be it blockchain, be it crypto, be it RPA, any of those buzzwords. And actually, we're also working on a blockchain certificate program right now as we speak. And a quick plug for Lehman. Lehman was the first school in the CUNY system to actually issue transcripts on a blockchain-based platform in May. So cool stuff on there. Yeah, so very forward-thinking place.
Yeah, I mean, that's an actual great application for blockchain in general, right? Because there's a lot of fraud that goes on, I believe, with
higher education transcripts and grades. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so the whole blockchain conversation, it's primarily focused like on Bloomberg, Fox Business, MSNBC, whatever your flavor is. That conversation tends to be focused on the market side of it, right? On the cryptocurrency, on the trading side of it. But blockchain has implications for any industry that has information.
Exactly.
So it's every industry. Healthcare, property records, tax records, not-for-profit, tracking those inflows and outflows. Any industry that has information from customers or from suppliers or partners can be augmented or improved using blockchain.
So let's talk a bit about the financial industry.
Sure.
What are the traditional challenges for those, I guess, that haven't necessarily lived through or were around when the recession occurred?
Mm-hmm. I mean, so I'd say that there are a few headwinds out there right now in the financial services area at large. Probably the two that come to mind the most often are automation, right? That as tasks are automated, these institutions don't need as many people. And so then from a bottom line point of view, short term, it's a positive. But in the future, if you and your employee base are a smaller percentage of the overall workforce, you aren't going to be as important. And then two, this, as a result of that automation, the margin compression is tremendous, right? From Vanguard to Blackstone, BlackRock, all of the big behemoths, right? In the private equity space, in the retail space, all of them consistently point to those two things. Automation and that automation sort of driving down margins in their industries are two of the biggest headwinds out there right now. Hence, all of these sort of non-traditional companies trying to get into the space, right? Leveraging, one, these automation tools, and two, also trying to take advantage of the fact that as a non-bank or as a non-incumbent institution, they aren't bound by all of this regulation that a legacy institution has to comply with. Now, of course, as these entrants start to get into the payments and the money transmission business, there are some Congress people, regulators, who are advocating for, well, hold on now. If you're moving into the banking space and you're acting like a bank, walking like a bank, and talking like a bank, then you should be treated as a bank.
Now, who could that be?
I don't know. I mean, there's this tiny, tech startup, Facebook, tiny company, sort of a minnow out there right now. But yeah, Facebook is probably the prime example right now, right? For good or bad, right? Because Facebook has been in the spotlight, well, for a number of other reasons anyway, but most currently because they're basically the face of this whole Libra project. Now, it's important to note and to point out that even though it's called Facebook's Libra and it's Facebook that's most often linked to it, from an operational point of view, on paper at least, Facebook is one of 28 companies who are part of the governing body that ultimately will sort of drive and manage Libra. So even though it's linked most powerfully to them, right here at least, they're only on paper one of a group of firms that is managing it. But yeah. During the hearings that happened earlier in July, there were some heads of banks basically saying, all right, well, if Facebook wants to get into our business, then they should be treated as such.
So let's unpack that a little bit. What the heck is Libra and why do we need it?
How much time do you have? No, so at a really
much time as we need.
No, so at a really sort of basic level, right? Libra is designed or it's being marketed as a payment tool that will enable users of Facebook, right, to basically send funds back and forth and to pay for goods and services with Libra via Messenger without having to use dollars or euros or some other fiat currency. And fiat currency, all that means is a currency issued by a government, right? Mm-hmm. But so it's a very basic purpose, but unpacking that purpose, then there are some questions that are asked, right? So how is this Libra coin actually going to be backed, right? How is it going to have value, right? Because a U.S. dollar has value because it's backed by the U.S. government. So then how does Libra have value? And that's where it really gets a little interesting or terrifying, depending on who you ask. So in the hearings that happened on July 16th and 17th, it came out during the testimony of their head of this Libra project, David Marcus. He stated that the coin itself is going to be supported or backed overall by half U.S. dollar assets and then half other assets. So all of that raises some interesting questions too. And, well, probably the one that's most important is if I trade $100 in for 100 Libra and then I want to trade it back out into dollars, how does that process work? Am I able to get back out of Libra after I convert it in? Because it's not like some other coins out there where it's backed one-to-one U.S. dollar per coin, then it's a pretty basic process to follow. I convert it back and forth. But if I convert it into Libra, and so that Libra is backed only half by the U.S. dollar and half by some other assets, how does that conversion process work for me? But more on the point of sort of how it connects to the sort of financial services space is, okay, fine. How is Facebook going to guarantee that Libra and sort of that underlying blockchain is in compliance with OFAC, AML, KYC, money laundering? Who's going to be in charge of making sure that if I'm trying to sign up for Facebook to purchase Libra, that I'm not doing it for some criminal reason, right? Who's going to be in charge of that? What safeguards are in place? And all of those questions were asked and are being asked. As of right now, there are not too many satisfactory answers as far as the people in Congress are concerned. But really, sort of Libra, it's a type of cryptocurrency called a stablecoin. And all that means...
Stablecoin?
Yeah, a stablecoin. And all that means is that on paper, it's more stable, right, than a Bitcoin, which goes up and down quite a bit. And so the purpose of it is to give users here and internationally, more importantly, a unit of account or a way to do transactions, to pay for goods and services that aren't always going to be linked to the, you know, mood swings of people in power, either here in the U.S. or overseas, in terms of heads of state, bankers, politicians at large.
Why does Facebook or these 28 bodies need this coin?
So that's a very good question, and there really has not been a good answer given by Facebook's head. Basically, their sort of answer right now is that they are doing this to try to give their 2.7 billion users a easy way to conduct e-commerce on their platform. And yeah, so
I didn't know Facebook was an e-commerce platform.
Well, I didn't know either, right? But apparently they're trying to sort of augment that. And I think they're doing that because they're feeling some pressure from other big social media companies, Alibaba, Tencent, that have sort of managed to merge social, search, payment processing all under one house. So I do think that's a part of it too.
Interesting. Yeah. How long do you think it is before Amazon and Google come out with their own coins?
It was very interesting because on August 1st and August 2nd, a press release came out that Walmart had actually filed a patent and had put information out into the marketplace for their version of a product that looks a lot like Facebook's Libra.
Walmart.
So yeah, I mean Walmart, you know, I mean old school here, but are you keeping up with the times? So I'd say that sort of given that information, it isn't going to be too long before Amazon, Microsoft, even Google issue their own white papers for their own blockchain products that help with payments or other types of sort of payment processes built under their platforms. If it's the end of 2019 and Facebook is the only tech company that has one, I'll be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, I feel like, you know, creating your own either token or currency or some type of mechanism to transact in an ecosystem like Facebook, like all these other social channels, social media platforms, is almost like a no-brainer, because all of these ICOs that hit a couple of years ago that are now poo-pooed everywhere, and it's a bad word, that's ultimately what they were doing. And now it's becoming a bit more of a legitimate process, I guess, for if Facebook is taking on sort of, is it, can I call it an ICO?
Well, I wouldn't call it a ICO per se, but what I would say is that, to your point, overall, right, since 2016, right, since Bitcoin burst out into the mainstream marketplace, there has been a shift going on all through 2017, 2018, 2019, and I guarantee you in 2020, basically from sort of a decentralized open source model, sort of Wild West, like Bitcoin back in 2015, 2016, towards more of the incumbent players being involved, being a part of the blockchain crypto asset space, and trying to make this ecosystem fit under current guidelines. I would definitely say that's a trend, right? Because ICOs have gone quite quickly from this new, cool, awesome way to raise capital on a blockchain, which is one of the highest profile ones in 2017, Kick raised $100 million in 2017. And just earlier in June, the SEC filed a complaint versus that company. So yeah, it's turned quite quickly on that. But ICOs have evolved into STOs, a security token offering, which, if you actually analyze it, is awfully close to a traditional IPO. And so this whole shift from sort of decentralized, you know, open source to more centralized, but not totally centralized yet, but more of the incumbents, more frameworks, more oversight, is a definite trend out there. Absolutely.
Interesting. And I guess that's the beauty of why blockchain has raised so much interest, is because of that ability to decentralize and take some of the power away from companies like Facebook and Google at this point, and the banks and the financial institutions. But then you have the opposite powers trying to centralize, and we're trying to decentralize.
Of course, yeah. No, and it's important to know how we got here, right? Because Bitcoin and blockchain, that first white paper was published on Halloween 2008, right in the teeth of the market meltdown, you know, caused or involving, depending who you ask, right? There's you blame to go around. But the big banks were a part of that meltdown, right? The mortgage lenders, the banks, the credit bureaus, all of them were implicated in a way in that meltdown. And so Bitcoin and blockchain, that was developed as a way to, as you put, sort of decentralize that power, that authority, that custody, that sort of grip on that financial data, on the financial arteries of the world, and to then give it back to the individuals. But of course, over time, with the development of the ecosystem and the interest in blockchain by all of those incumbent players, from Toyota to Walmart to JP Morgan to Microsoft to Facebook, I mean, as these players, you know, one, understand the value of blockchain, and two, see how it could actually threaten their business models, all of them are pouring billions of dollars and thousands of people at this tool to try to get it to work in their system for them. Absolutely.
How far away do you think we are from a future predicated on Bitcoin and blockchain in banking specifically?
I would say that probably the future based on Bitcoin, I don't think that's a viable path forward. Just based on the price volatility and the feedback from the regulators, just on basically their current views on it. I don't think that a banking system based on Bitcoin is a viable option. Now, a banking system either based on or augmented by blockchain, I would say absolutely, that's a real possibility, right? Just earlier this year in February, JP Morgan launched their Quorum blockchain, and they've signed up over 200 banks to be part of their interbank information network, basically to use their version of blockchain to help do commercial payments. I mean, there is a tremendous value add from a banking side to use blockchain to help with the settlement of transactions, processing of payments and confirmations on both ends. So that, I would say, is a real possible future. And I'd say it's probably much closer than we think, because we have these big established incumbent players adopting it, right, using it. And there are a whole host of pilot projects basically set to launch either at the end of 2020 or early 2021. So I'd say that's going to be interesting to see sort of how these projects actually work, right? If on the day when you turn it on, is it actually going to work as advertised, right? Probably not perfectly, but I would say that that's a possible future. I'd say within 5 to 8 years, yeah.
What do you think some of the problems they'll encounter initially?
I think probably one of the basic problems that they're going to encounter is how these blockchains talk to each other, right? How they interoperate with each other. So a good example that I always give is how much trouble is it at a big firm to upgrade your email system or your answering machine system? Mm. It's always a huge mess, right? Upgrading your email system in-house, right? Just right. Inside your company. Now, imagine trying to build a network to connect over 200 banks, over 500 banks, however big it is, on top of your current systems, which aren't perfect either, right? Mm-hmm. And imagine all of those problems and the bugs and the coding errors and the gaps and the missing information that could possibly happen. I'd say that that's probably the biggest issue, how they interoperate, and then sort of a 1B is how this ultimately gets treated from a regulatory point of view, right? So are there policies in place to make sure that as we're transitioning or that as banks or as consumers transition from the current system to a blockchain system, how do we make sure that all of the rules and the protections, the guidelines, the frameworks, all the rest are kept in place as the whole process changes, right? So how do we keep the rules still in force and working as the whole process that they're trying to enforce changes overnight, right? So
that would be interesting.
How does that process work? Yeah.
Now, the 200 banks that you're talking about, are they building their own private blockchain where it's closed off into those particular banks? And how do you envision that working?
Sure. So from all of the, you know, data published by JP Morgan, basically they had built that, right? So basically what they did at a very high level was take the public blockchain, Ethereum, and then sort of take that source code, edit it, tweak it, sort of make it work for them internally, and then call it Quorum. Basically try to create their own version of Ethereum built for, you know, their commercial payment network. And then JP Morgan serves the role as the organizing firm, or the head firm, basically, of this IIN. And so then they've been asking banks to sign up to be a part of it. And so as a result of that, those other banks, those 200 banks, 300 banks, however many are signed up, right, at the go live date, will then be linked in to that JP Morgan blockchain, that sort of private blockchain.
Hold that thought. Let's take a quick break and thank our sponsors. The production of the Amplified podcast has been brought to you by Social Fix Media. Social Fix is a transformational growth hacker agency focused on emerging technology platforms, video and podcast production, content marketing, and overall startup strategy. Social Fix has helped over 300 clients generate millions of dollars in revenue, fundraising, and profit. If you'd like help launching or growing your business, visit socialfix.com. And what would be some of the areas that would be transformed through the use of this technology for them? Like, what's going to change for these banks?
Sure. So I'd say probably the most obvious thing that is going to change first, one, how long it takes transactions to actually settle, right? And so from a consumer point of view, I go use Apple Pay to go buy some pizza. I'm done in 2 seconds. That transaction, it can take up to 4 business days to actually settle out on the back ends. That's forever these days. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah.
And it's that way because of all of the different correspondent bank relationships, correspondent balances, people have to be involved, and the fact that there are so many different systems that have to talk to each other. So if you're able to get an industry standard or an industry platform set up where all of us basically agree to do things in a certain way, then that could really cut down on it. And JP Morgan has come out saying that their upfront goal is to cut the settlement time from days to hours, and then ultimately from hours down to minutes. So that's the huge benefit right there. And just to add an extra little wrinkle in here, the vector by which that time is going to be saved is the fact that as a part of this launch, JP Morgan actually is also going to launch their own coin, the stable coin, JPM coin. Mm. But it's only going to be used inside of that network, basically to help convert the dollars, euros, yens, whatever, into JPM coin, have those transfer on that Quorum blockchain, and then at the end, convert back into the currencies in question. So to answer or to sort of point out sort of how that time saving actually is going to get done at JP Morgan, they are going to roll out their own coin to sort of help with that process.
So would that be considered kind of like a utility token?
They didn't go that far, but I would argue that because right now there is no case, there is no plan for these coins to be traded outside of the network, I would say so, yeah. I mean, because it's only going to be used as a part of that blockchain. So it's only utility is as a part of the network.
I guess if I'm not mistaken, I think Ripple performs that same type of function. Mm-hmm. Is it international transfers?
XRP. Or? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Ripple blockchain, they were basically doing this. They were the first company to actually try to work with the banking regulators and banks to basically set up this international platform, right? And it was very interesting to observe their reaction to the Quorum launch. And even from a bigger picture point of view, international transactions or transactions between banks are settled via SWIFT. And mm-hmm. SWIFT has been around for decades. And so both of these projects, either Ripple or Quorum, are basically, if you actually analyze them, trying to disrupt SWIFT and to basically become the new standard for how payments are processed and how transactions are settled, both intra-country and inter-country too, which also caused SWIFT to launch their own blockchain project. So it's very interesting to see it. Yeah, it's sort of like the dominoes, running around out there. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, initially they were all against it, yep. And now everybody's in it. The challenger banks that are popping up right now all over the place, they, to me, are a no-brainer because I feel like going to the bank is an inconvenience. And I think a lot of people obviously, may feel that way. What do you think about that?
I'd say that, the idea of a fully online bank is a good idea, frankly, because then you're able to offer the services of a bank without the costs of the branches and the people and the infrastructure on site, which, as you pointed out, most people really don't enjoy going to the bank branch anyway. So it's not as if having those branches adds any value, right, to the consumer experience of your bank, right? Most people just want it to be fast, convenient, and to give them the best deal possible, right? And so I'd say that analyzed through that lens, if you are able to operate, obviously, in compliance with all of the banking rules, but to do so without all of those costs of a legacy institution, makes sense.
Who's going to be the Uber of challenger banks?
That's awfully tough. There are a number of them out there who are doing good work. But I also want to point out that the incumbent players aren't just hanging out, right? Goldman Sachs launched a AI-powered online banking platform for individuals, Marcus. Launched powered by AI, online only. So, there is some pushback or some competition now from the incumbent players because they see it coming too, right? That the idea of a bank branch in the town is not as appealing to people. And it's not adding any value to the consumer experience of banking. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see. And I would not be surprised if the incumbent banks begin to buy up some of these online-only banks.
Very good point. What do you think about crypto exchanges? They're kind of playing in that same bank space, with their floating in and out of regulation. And
so that's an interesting question because they aren't perfect, right? In May, one of the top platforms, Binance, had their hot wallet hacked. And without diving into too many details, a hot wallet is basically a online portal for consumers or investors to access their crypto holdings. Mm-hmm. And so their hot wallets were hacked.
So the hot wallet lives on the platform itself. It's not like the hard versus the hard wallet, which is the USB port,
yep.
That you lose it, you're done.
Yeah.
This is the temporary coins that you transfer from your hard wallet to the portal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in that hot wallet, though, what most folks don't know is that on a platform like Coinbase or Binance, which are the two biggest ones, most of the high-profile ones here in the U.S., your public key and your private key are both held in that hot wallet. So meaning that if that hot wallet is hacked, those hackers have direct access to your private key and therefore have direct access to your Bitcoin holdings. So in the case of Binance, they had hot wallets hacked, and it was only the Bitcoin hot wallets got hacked. And in the span of, I believe it was only a few hours, over 7,000 Bitcoin were stolen, worth at the time $40.7 million. And because Bitcoin, yeah, that's a lot of money. And it gets better. Because Bitcoin is not treated as an equity security, there is no FDIC insurance, there's no investor insurance. So then those folks are out of luck, basically.
Right.
And so I do think that's an important thing to keep in mind as you're talking about crypto trading platforms and all the rest, that most of these have only popped up within the last 4, 5, 6 years. So the infrastructure and the people running them don't always have the depth of market expertise that a more long-lived player might. But I mean, it's a very interesting space. But the one thing that I would caution is that if you're holding your information on a platform, I mean, there is a element of risk in there.
Are there any exchanges that secure their users in any way?
I mean, I would say that that is not something that I've seen advertised, right, as a function of a platform, and that most individuals who are trying to sort of be more proactive in sort of safeguarding their data probably use a combination, right, of the hot wallets for their certain, like, you know, operational costs of day-to-day use, and then their cold wallets for the items that they want to hold more sort of medium to long-term, right? And to basically have, ultimately, two separate addresses. One address linked to the hot wallet for those, you know, day-to-day buying pizza, buying coffee with your Bitcoin, and then the other address linked offline to that cold wallet to hold on to those assets for the medium to sort of longer term.
What about, I don't know if you know of any or any examples of where the exchanges themselves have been manipulated as far as price surges and price falls?
So I would say sort of there's a part A to that and a part B. So I would start with the price question. And I know that there was some speculation back at the end of 2017, early 2018, that huge run-up in Bitcoin was caused by a few sort of large holders or a few institutions that were trying to, you know, increase the price, basically do a little pump and dump type of action there. And there was no hard evidence ever found, no charges brought, but there was a lot of conversation based on just analyzing the actual trading volumes of Bitcoin that it seems as if there could have been a few big players making big moves to help increase and then lower the price. So, and in a market where there is not as much well-established regulation and the individual investors aren't as aware of how it works from a technical point of view, there is going to be an increased risk that if there are some well-informed players, well-funded players, or well-established players that have large holdings, that, yeah, they could definitely have some impact on the price going up or coming down. On the asset side, right, on the Bitcoin, Litecoin, whatever side. But on the exchange side, I have not heard too much on those being, you know, overtly or covertly sort of managed under the radar yet. But that could change with the advent of an IEO, initial exchange offering. That as these new platforms get launched, then if they're launched and they're only controlled by a handful of people, then there's a higher risk of some unethical or some bad actors sort of taking advantage of that information asymmetry, right, to defraud investors, basically steal assets that are put on the platform or some other items like that. So that's going to be interesting to watch how many of these new platforms being launched via this IEO process actually turn out to be still here in 2, 3, 4 years. That's going to be very interesting to watch, I think.
The last time I checked, regulation for crypto exchanges in the U.S., mm-hmm. I believe you were not regulated or permitted to take investor money from the U.S. Is that still the case?
I believe so. I have not heard anything to the contrary on that. And I know that as far as Coinbase goes, for example, they have been trying to get more into the good graces of the regulators following their court case with the IRS. back in 2017 and in 2018. They're licensed now as a money transmitter. In most states, they were granted a custodial banking license. So they are trying to become more and more part of that sort of mainstream framework, more of an incumbent player, mirroring our earlier conversation, right? Sort of coming in from the Wild West, but now sort of being licensed, working with regulators, trying to become more established to hopefully be able to then take investor money to help grow and all the rest, or to even launch their own additional tokens going forward.
Can you even be based in the U.S. if you're a crypto exchange platform?
Yes.
Or would you have to be based out of the U.S.?
You can be based here.
The recent Bitcoin surge, it was, I think, the last time I checked, up to 13,000 maybe about a month ago, up from what was it, 8?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I know earlier in the year it was down around 3,800, 4,500. Then it ran up, and I believe it briefly touched almost $14,000. Earlier in the spring, maybe April, May. Now it's been trading at around $9,000, $10,000. But there is a sort of, well, on the crypto Twitter, at the very least, there's a bullish sort of sentiment out there or feeling, because that level of 10,000 is often viewed as sort of a technical breakthrough level, right? And that if it can hold that level or trade above it, then it could be set for a run up. But what I also think is driving this is that as there's more institutional interest and public hearings and conversations on all kinds of blockchain, be it JP Morgan, Libra, IBM, Walmart, as it becomes more sort of part of the mainstream conversation, then it's viewed less as a criminal tool or as a high risk choice and more just as a alternative asset class. Right. And there are college endowments that have put money into crypto. There are pension funds, hedge funds, PE funds that are putting real institutional money now into this space. And so as that continues, I do think that that will help, won't guarantee, but it will help sort of provide a floor under those prices going forward. And it's also important to keep in mind that as of August 1st, there was a press release put out that now 18.5 million of the total 21 million Bitcoins have actually been mined. So it's going to be interesting to see that as we get closer to that hard cap of Bitcoins, sort of what impact that has on the price of the coins out there, right? Will it behave more like gold then, right? Sort of a fixed level of it, and so then that drives the price? Or is that mining being complete going to then turn it into an actual currency tool, right? Or an actual real currency option? So that's going to be interesting to see, and depending on who you ask, there are folks out there saying that now Bitcoin is going to go up to $200,000 per coin, $1 million per coin. And there are other folks out there saying that as it gets more mainstream and more accepted and more talked about and more regulated, that then it could actually be used as a currency, which is not going to have as big an impact on the price level as it being treated just as a asset class. So it's very interesting right now, and it's really hard to tell where it's ultimately going to end up. But yeah, it has recovered quite a bit. I believe it's up something from the beginning of the year. I think it's up something between 100% and 200%. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's so it has been a good year if you held it sort of long term. But outside of that, it's awfully hard to forecast where the price is ultimately going to end up.
How do you think that what you just described, as in, there's a finite number of Bitcoins available out on the market, they've almost been mined to completion. Mm-hmm. How does the Bitcoin performance or behavior impact all the other coins?
So it has a big impact. Even right now, because there are 2,100 coins and tokens out there. But even that said, Bitcoin, and it varies per day, but it's been consistent between 50 and at its peak, something like 62% of the overall market cap or the market value of the whole sort of crypto asset space is linked to Bitcoin. So it still has a huge impact on the overall sort of marketplace, be it Ether, be it Litecoin, be it XRP. I mean, they all pretty much track what Bitcoin does in terms of price movements, up, down, sideways, whatever.
If you were looking to analyze a particular currency, what would you look at? What would be the types of elements or aspects of a coin would you look at?
Sure. So if I had to analyze a specific crypto asset, be it a stable coin or more traditional cryptocurrency, I would look at a few things. One, what is its actual use case, right? Is there a use case for it? And then part two, based on that, is there a white paper that I can read, right? Is the coding language outlined? Is that use case outlined anywhere that I can actually see, read, and sort of analyze myself? Three, is there a management team involved? At Bitcoin, there is no management team. But at coins like the Paxos Standard, Gemini Dollar, Libra, there are management teams. There's a structure, there's a hierarchy in place. So who are those people? And also, what is their background in this space? And then point four, what are they doing to work with regulators, right? Are they being antagonistic? Are they being cooperative? You know, and so what is that trend? And then point five, what are those people saying their ultimate goal is, right? Because having a goal in the white paper is one thing, but then having the goal as actually stated by management, it can be something entirely different. Right. So then what is that goal or the purpose of this coin? Is it built to be used as a currency, or is it built to be used as part of a blockchain, right? Like the XRP, JPM coin, right? Is it built to be used as almost a sort of Groupon to get goods and services? Are we going to use it as part of a tokenization process? Are we going to tokenize a building, issue tokens for cash, you know, and then have those token holders granted access rights to the building or share of the profits, right? So how is the token going to work, and how is it going to fit into the business model of some bigger picture entity, if any? Or like Bitcoin, is it totally sort of decentralized, untethered to any business or asset, and sort of honestly put out there as a alternative, right? Sort of to the fiat system. Mm-hmm. But sort of those are the factors that I would analyze. Who's in charge? Is there a purpose outline? How is it linked to a business? And then how are they coordinating with regulators, right? And the whole accounting conversation is a whole separate ball of wax, right? Because we have all of these firms launching coins, tokens, building blockchains. There is no guidance out there as to how to actually classify these things on the balance sheet, on the income statement, how to show them, are they property, are they intangible assets, are they investments, are they currency equivalents, and then how do we show the gains and losses on these, you know, Bitcoins or other crypto assets? All of those are still unanswered questions at the FASB level, at the IASB level, PCAOB. All of those agencies are hopefully, you know, working on it right now. But as far as sort of public statements, public guidance, accounting standards, there aren't too many out there yet. The only agency that has come out with guidance is the IRS from 2014. And basically that guidance says anything that's a virtual currency is treated as property. So anytime that it moves or changes hands, it's taxed.
Right.
Which has also proved to be a big headwind, keeping consumers and merchants from actually using it as currency, because if I want to use Bitcoin to buy pizza, I have to pay for the pizza, pay any, you know, sales tax on it, and then also track the price of that coin when I got it, the price of the coin when I used it, and then owe income tax on that difference.
How's that even going to happen?
I mean, that's a huge issue. And actually, at the end of July, the IRS basically issued a press release saying they are going to be mailing out 10,000 letters by the end of August to people who they believe owe taxes linked to their crypto holdings. And they have a few versions of this letter: nice, medium, and then mean, basically. So it's going to be interesting to see sort of how that works and how that plays out. But they've come out pretty strongly saying that sort of this crypto tax enforcement is going to be a hot topic and a priority for them going forward, because they issued a statement, I believe, and I forget if it was after the 2018 filing season or after the 2017 filing season, but they had analyzed their records, and based on their internal workup, they estimated that only between 7 and 8% of all people who owed taxes on crypto holdings actually paid them. So obviously they weren't happy about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of confusion for people on what it is that they even have to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge challenge, and it's also compounded by the fact that there are, you know, platforms to trade these assets on, like Coinbase. But as of right now, platforms like that are under no obligation to issue you 1099s. Mm-hmm. Now, that's in the process of being changed, but in 2017, when basically any holder of Bitcoin or some other cryptocurrency had these huge gains, there was a lot of confusion as to how to show it, what to show, and then also how to get that information. So yeah, I mean, that sort of information gap, and again, that sort of lack of integration into the framework structures of the current financial system is a issue that has to be worked on.
So what do you predict as far as what we have to watch out for in the next 2-3 years, maybe?
I mean, I'd say really in the next 2-3 years, I'd say that it's almost like a two-track conversation. On the blockchain side, I mean, the train has left the station, right? It's coming. There are these big companies that have put so much money, time, and people into it. It's coming right now. From a consumer point of view, we probably won't notice it right away up front, but it's coming for pretty much every aspect, whether it's title, insurance, intellectual property, copyright payments, banking, healthcare, infrastructure, power grids. All of these things are being worked on. Transportation, shipping, all of these are being worked on. There are platforms being built out in all of these areas. So I do think that's coming. As far as the crypto asset side goes, that's a little more murky, right? Because there's some crackdown on Bitcoin, right? And as of right now, there aren't any products out there for individual investors to use to buy a basket of underlying crypto assets, right? There have been, I think, 12 or 13 ETFs filed at the SEC, and all of them were turned down because Bitcoin, that underlying asset, is too volatile. So I do think that that's going to be the more contentious side, right? But I do think, and from the trends that I've seen here and pretty much everywhere that I go, the trend and the sort of theme is that we're moving less towards a decentralized open source and more towards of a more centralized, more sort of stable coin, more regulated type of asset space. And I'd say that's where we will ultimately end up if coins like that want to get used as currencies. Now, if they're happy just being viewed as a asset class by themselves, I'd say that could be a little more less regulated or less tethered. But I do think even in that crypto asset space, we're going to see sort of a bifurcation, right? Coins that are issued to be used for stuff, whether as a Groupon or as a token linked to a project, or to be used as currency, and then other coins and tokens issued to raise capital and then trade. So I do think that's ultimately where we're going to go, but I do think that's going to take a few years to shake out to see how that all plays out. And it all ultimately comes down to how the regulators see this, right? Because if they see it as a threat to the financial system or as a threat to consumer protection, then sort of that could throw a whole wrench into the works too. So it's going to be very interesting, I think, 2-4 years going forward.
What's the one thing that you would like our audience to take away from this episode?
I'd say that the one thing to keep in mind is if you're an investor or you're a company or you're an entrepreneur thinking about blockchain, crypto assets, either as a fundraising tool to use in your business, to do an airdrop as a PR move, it's really important to understand that every blockchain is different and that every crypto asset is different, and that it's really important to understand what you are getting into, how they work, how it's going to help you, and then also what your potential exposure is as you're getting into this space.
When's your fifth book coming out?
Fifth book, that should be coming out either at the end of 2019 or early 2020.
Well, you got to let me know.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much. I think you're absolutely brilliant.
Ah, no.
Very informative, and I appreciate your time being
absolutely
here.
Happy to do it.
Thanks for listening to the Amplify Podcast. Follow us on our social channels and subscribe on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts. On the next episode, stay tuned for more trailblazing insights, energy, and culture to help fuel your pursuit in the modern digital era.